Grant Smith is a director of research at the Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, or IRMEP, a Washington-based nonprofit organization. His analysis and research have appeared in the Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Reuters News Service, Associated Press, and in the State Department's specialty publication, Washington File. His recent book, Deadly Dogma, describes in detail the ways in which the neocons not only deceived America in pushing us into the war in Iraq and ever greater military spending, but he actually broke the law to do it. Welcome, Grant Smith.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's a great honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. Your book is packed with information that every American needs to have to find out what is going on in this country. Earlier in the program, I recalled how a little over a month ago, Greg Palast had written an obituary for the neocons, and looking what has been happening in Lebanon, watching the UN with John Bolton calling the shots, and after going through your book, Deadly Dogma, it would seem that any death notice for the neocons is somewhat premature, and fortunately premature. How would you call that?
I agree 100%. I think to hear Palast give the idea that kicking John Bolton into the UN, whether John Bolton's been approved by Congress or not, putting him in the UN is certainly not nullifying his power by any means. And I think if you pick apart the Palast article, you can find a lot of flaws and assumptions that most people don't share here in Washington in terms of neoconservative power.
Well, actually, he was responding to a paper that John Mearsheim and Stephen Wall, two distinguished professors, had written on the influence of the Israeli lobby in fomenting U.S. Middle East policy. And, of course, the neocons are part of that lobby.
Right.
You have also written another book about the clean break, which is something that is a buzzword among those people who are familiar with what the neocons and the lobby have been done to try and influence U.S. policy and Israeli policy, but perhaps you can talk about that, because we're going to get into that in the program.
Sure. If we think about the AIPAC and other parts of the Israel lobby that Mearsheimer and Walt mentioned, we would say that that's essentially the operating system. But if we look at the Clean Break program, we believe that's the program that they've been running essentially since the Bush administration began changing its policy post 9/11 in the region. The Clean Break plan, for those who are not familiar with it, was a 1996 policy paper written by many prominent American neoconservatives for Benjamin Netanyahu, entering prime minister in 1996, to give him some ideas about how he should conduct strategy in the region and make a break with the past, hence the name, A Clean Break. The names of the study group will certainly be recognizable to many listeners. Richard Perle, who at that time was at American Enterprise Institute, but subsequently became the chair of the Defense Policy Board. Douglas Feith, who then was a lawyer, but then rose in to become Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon. And David Wormser, who continues to this day being Dick Cheney's chief Middle East advisor, wrote a paper which had 32 separate and distinct policy objectives, some of which are extremely radical in terms of a break with the past, including the idea that Saddam Hussein should be replaced with a monarchy that would be friendly to Israel, that Hezbollah needed to be confronted in Lebanon and Syria, ejected from the country, and that Israel would need to continue to thwart aid and any sort of support to the Palestinian government, that Syria should be contained, and an emphasis should be made on Syrian weapons of mass destruction as a way to further isolate it. Last point, the idea of WMD was then shifted tactically to make the argument for an invasion of Iraq. But we can see a number of clean break activities in play today, and it's an extremely important document for people who are growing tired of the focus on support for the troops, duck and run type arguments that dominate the media debate, and really want to look into the policy formulation process and whose ideas have come to be dominant.
Well, from your institute, and we've got the information how to get that afterward. You have the whole clean break document, and you just here's one suggestion. I'm just quoting: striking Syrian military targets in Lebanon, should that prove insufficient, striking select targets in Syria proper.
Right. Well, and that of course has happened, transpired when they struck an abandoned Palestinian training camp in Lebanon. But until now, the focus has been on implementing this idea, again, of challenging Syria. And we've issued a report called Clean Break or Dirty War, because many of the implementation, we believe, has many aspects of dirty wars that have occurred in places such as Argentina, where there are inexplicable assassinations and deaths. We can certainly point to Rafik Hariri's untimely death in Beirut as being one of those, where suddenly the dynamic changed for inexplicable reasons, still unknown actors, and a major policy goal was then implemented, in this case forcing Syria out of Lebanon and paving the way for a freer hand, we believe, in this case, for Israel to act as it has recently in invading the country under various pretexts.
It's interesting that when the neocons joined the both houses of Congress in a cheering section for Israel when they invaded Lebanon, they were later publicly very disappointed, including Charles Krauthammer, one of their leading media spokespersons, because Israel didn't launch a more thorough ground attack earlier. And so much of the criticism they're making, the neocons made, is being actually made by the right wing in Israel, the Netanyahu crowd.
Right. I think it's interesting, and to focus on other thought leaders on the issue. Seymour Hersh, of course, came out with a piece saying that all of this makes perfect strategic sense, in that he and others have mentioned there was a briefing on this attack, which would be launched under whatever pretext offered itself by major Israeli military figures who visited in May of this year, talking about target selection and attacking Lebanon now that Syria was out, which was received, again, in the Pentagon. Seymour Hersh speculates, and based on his discussions with high-level intelligence figures, believes that this was a necessary tactical move to free up the United States for a future strike on Iran by eliminating Hezbollah rockets and minimizing their positions and trench positions in the south of Lebanon. This would give the U.S. a freer hand and wouldn't have to worry about that flank if indeed strategic bombing takes place against targets in Iran. So, again, I think Americans are hungry for information that makes sense. When, of course, we invaded Iraq, many people jumped on the bandwagon of weapons of mass destruction, but now that 60% of the people believe that was a false pretext, I think there's more initial desire for solid analysis of the real factors in the region and Washington, which can explain some of these acts, such as, again, cutting 42 bridges, destroying the airport, and the overwhelming response of the Israeli Defense Forces against Lebanon for what was, historically speaking, a very commonplace event and a gambit to generate a prisoner exchange on Hezbollah's part.
Well, I actually, as I reported earlier, the initial reports of the capture of the soldiers reported that, at least in Forbes and Agence France-Presse, that the capture took place in Lebanon, but Israel was apparently looking for some kind of a pretext, and and believed their own press clippings about these so-called elite units that had got their elite characteristics of the name elite units some 30 years ago, when actually Israel was fighting in wars against armies and not kicking in the doors of Palestinian homes and humiliating people in checkpoints.
I think you missed something there, though. There is a story that extends even a little bit further in terms of Lebanon being angered by what are essentially Israeli death squads operating in the south of Lebanon. In June, and this was reported, I believe, also by Agence France and a couple of other foreign news outlets, they captured Abu Rafe, who was a Mossad collaborator who had assassinated various Hezbollah figures in 1999 and even 2004. So there was plenty of angst and reason for Hezbollah to want to retaliate while also confronting the real problem of administrative detainees and the fact that there is no formalized way for parties in the conflict to exchange prisoners or even discuss these sorts of events, which are always simmering on that particular border. But in terms of pretext, we've said this in other reports, the whole Saving Private Ryan, which is the media frame in the United States, Corporal Shalit and other Israelis being captured and or imperiled behind enemy lines, is beginning to unravel as more Americans look outside the bubble here in the U.S. and into some of the foreign sources reporting the details since preceding the invasion.
Well, the day before, actually, the Palestinians staged a commando raid and captured Corporal Shalit. Israel came in and kidnapped two brothers inside Gaza, and they regularly have been kidnapping Palestinian civilians for years. This is dictionary definition of kidnapping, where soldiers, by no dictionary definition, when they're in active duty, could be considered kidnapped, of course, unless they're Israeli. Even when American soldiers are captured in Iraq, have been captured in other places, they don't call them kidnapped, they call them captured, but they make the language when it comes to Israelis, it seems to be a little bit different, and they seem to be like innocent Boy Scouts out for a spring walk when they're grabbed by a nasty Palestinians or Lebanese and speared away, where they're going to do terrible things to them.
I think that is a problem, and if Americans had any sense of history, they would know what a thorn and what a ongoing problem during our own revolution and break from the British, the impressment of American sailors was into the British Navy. It was something that just continued to grind and create frustration, and the whole idea of habeas corpus and actually having a process for presenting the body, as it were, and having a process for prisoner exchange or at least charges is so important. But in this case, of course, there is no process, and you have, I believe the last figure I heard was some 10,000 Palestinians under administrative detention, including children and women, with no clear process to get out. And I think the in terms of the June timeline for the Israeli incursion into Gaza, of course we have a tragedy which, again, did not make U.S. news media, on which was the attack on a beach which resulted in the death of almost an entire Palestinian family that was having a picnic. I believe that occurred on June 8th. There was a video which ran almost in an endless loop over Arab satellite channels of a little girl looking at her eight family members that died after Israel shelled the beach. And that, again, caused tremendous pent-up anger and at least among lower levels of Hamas, probably caused them to act out in anger and launching their homemade Qassam rocket.
And of course, Israel said that was a Palestinian mine that did it, because they never admit to committing any kind of crime. Let's get back to the subject. very closely linked to a clean break was the document called the Project for a New American Century, which actually was first revealed in a Scottish newspaper. And this has some of the very same players that we have with the clean break. Perhaps you can talk about the Project for a New American Century, what that entailed.
Sure. The Project for a New American Century is an 501c3 that issued a number of policy position papers, the most famous of which is called Rebuilding American Defenses. In Rebuilding American Defenses, if you read it carefully, there are two things that are of extreme interest these days for Americans looking for the core policies of this nation. Number one was they were foreseeing that their grandiose plans for building up American war GDP on arms would probably not occur except if there were a cataclysmic or catalyzing event. People would later think of 9/11 as that catalyzing event, although the paper was written before 9/11. Number two, it's very clear in Rebuilding America's Defenses, the policy paper, that the idea of a permanent military presence moved from Saudi Arabia north and able to project power over the region while securing Israel's eastern flank was a major policy objective. Some have described this as the OIL acronym, OIL, Israel, and Logistics. And that's very clearly in the heart of Rebuilding America's Defenses policy document. Well, this policy document was written right before the 2000 election and Bush win, and the people who wrote it were essentially ushered in to the Pentagon and into the White House precisely to implement Rebuilding America's Defenses and put into action a lot of the particular policies that they were advocating in the paper. We mentioned the Project for a New American Century in Deadly Dogma from another angle. If you want to look at the narratives' efforts to get their policies implemented, there are times when they exhibit not only contempt for international law, but also contempt for domestic law. Some of the key figures in the Project for a New American Century include Bill Kristol, who's financed primarily by News Corp and Rupert Murdoch, Richard Pearl, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, James Woolsey, John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Richard Armitage. They were very interested in getting their policy prescription into operation. When we look, however, at the tax filings of PNAC, what we notice are, although it's broadly chartered as a nonprofit to discuss policy and put forward ideas through publications, the entity itself published almost no information throughout its most active period and was essentially a front group for what we believe was doing research and analysis that was subsequently sold through the Weekly Standard, which is a Bill Kristol organ of policy for the entire neoconservative galaxy here in Washington, D.C. So when we make allegations of tax fraud, all we have to do with tax returns, all we have to do is point out that in PNAC's case, less than 1% of the revenue that they received from wealthy donors was actually engaged and dedicated to the core cause of the nonprofit, while most of the people on the payroll were actually selling their content through a for-profit magazine. This is probably one of the most technical and smallest charges we make in the book, Deadly Dogma, but it's relevant because when you start peeling away the layers of some of these major policy papers and looking at the actions of some of the actors, you begin to see illegal activity and unindicted crimes that should receive more prosecutorial attention, in our view.
Well, you describe it and make it solid evidence. This is like a new mafia, that they really not only pay no attention to international law, but they see U.S. law as something they could skip, eliminate, not even pay any attention to, and get away with it. Incidentally, you have the title of the book is Deadly Dogma, and you list six dogmas, and they're really important. I want to read them because people, listeners, will recognize this has become essentially American policy and American life today. The dogma of first strike, preemptive strike. Unlimited military spending. There is no debate anymore on the amount of military spending.
No.
Noble lies. We've had enough of noble lies. Plunder and saturate the media networks. We have the think tanks in which neocons are always the talking heads. We have number five, primacy of Israel. That those who are Jewish and those who are non-Jewish have this affinity, like Bolton, to Israel. And Israel's always figuring very openly in their strategy decisions. And sixth, international law is non-binding. They said that publicly. The president has said that publicly. So this, and then you have espionage, conspiracy, wire frauds, military contract frauds, extortion negotiation with foreign governments, false tax returns, bribery of public officials. It's all in there, and it's there, and yet you don't see this in the mainstream press.
No, in fact, we were talking briefly about the indictment of two AIPAC lobbyists for essentially running Lawrence Franklin, a Pentagon official, and distributing classified documents to the press through AIPAC and also to Israel to forward their own policy goals. That particular case, if you read anything about it in the mainstream press, is being spun as a threat to First Amendment free speech rights, as though plundering classified information and trying to leverage it against the U.S. Is a right that we all have, an unabridged right that we all have. And it's not. I think there's a little bit of hope, although the judge who's presiding over the case, Judge Ellis, has made some incredibly, adverse opinions on other cases, recent cases that we could talk about. In this case, he's denied the defendant's claim that their free speech rights trump national security, and there is a case going forward against them. However, in terms of espionage, there's quite a bit of information about FBI investigations of 1969, in 1975, of Paul Wolfowitz in 1978, of Douglas Feith in 1983 and 2002, as well as Michael Ledeen and others, doing precisely the same thing, taking classified information, passing it on to the Israelis through unapproved and informal channels, all in an attempt to influence U.S. policymaking. And not only is the process by which they did it in violation of the 1917 Espionage Act, but there are also other acts which are on the books for good reason, which have not been enforced necessarily, such as the Logan Act, preventing freelance Americans from engaging in diplomacy and conspiring with foreign governments, which they violated. The other thing about Judge Ellis here in the Eastern Virginia District Court, the federal judge, has said the defendants also tried to get out of the AIPAC espionage case by saying that the 1917 Act has not recently been used to prosecute anyone, and that they thought that they should be freed because it was so seldom applied. Judge Ellis said simply because a law has not been used to prosecute violations should not be taken as any sort of license to commit crimes. So we're hopeful that in these developments, which occurred after the writing of the book, that a new serious level of attention can be paid to Logan Act, Espionage Act, and Foreign Agent Registration Act violations, in addition to the tax code charitable laundering and other charges that we've laid out in the book.
Well, it's clear that there are certain people within the intelligence services that are very disturbed at the penetration of the services and the kind of washing itself by the pro-Israel components. It's interesting and very depressing that the spin that is being made to defend these two AIPAC employees, former employees, and Rosen was a key employee there, as if this is a First Amendment case, and these men were journalists, and even, as I say, alternative media, these organizations that defend the First Amendment rights have risen to defend these two AIPAC employees as if they were journalists and they were getting information from Lawrence Franklin.
I think you're right, and it was such a golden opportunity to shine a light on policy formulation. You know, how is policy actually made, and open up a whole new discussion around the issue of if this is what's going on routinely in Washington, D.C. think tanks and the press. Does it have to be that way, and is that the best way for policy to be made? If these two lobbyists were releasing information tactically to pressure the Bush administration, not that they've come up with very many sound policies in the region, but if that were the case, is that the way it should be in light of all of these statutes on the books? But that discussion is not taking place.
There is this fear of being called or provoking anti-Semitism, and this is kind of a bugaboo that plagues the alternative media as much as it does the mainstream media. You do have two pages in the books which list the history, a short history of neocon espionage, as you mentioned. You have Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Michael Ledeen, Stephen Bryan. They have been accused, they've been found guilty, not filthy, not in court, of passing secrets on to Israel, and nothing happened. They got a slap on the wrist and they moved to another job.
Right. And, you know, again, the fact that they've recirculated and have continued to pop up really makes the case for us in terms of comparing them to a mafia, where self-promotion and filling certain roles with certain people, irrespective of past activities, is kind of the norm. I think, you know, if you look across the spectrum, you have different people in different roles. People like Bill Kristol, who's ubiquitous over media channels as the soft image and spreading the word, propagating the ideological views, along with David Brooks. They play some key roles in this network, we believe. You have enforcers such as Jonah Goldberg and Joel Mulbray, who will pop up and smear you with an anti-Semitism charge whenever you get too close to talking about the nitty-gritty of policymaking, and particularly the Israel lobby's role. You've got soldiers such as Michael Ledeen, who play these incredible central roles in Iran-Contra, who's been linked with the magazine that promoted the Niger forgeries in Italy, who's always tangentially involved, it seems, at the center of some dark activity overseas, but yet who we can never quite shine a clear light of day on. And you've got other people within the network who were maybe brought into it, such as Lawrence Franklin, who are sympathizers and very clearly on board in terms of unquestioning, unconditional support of Israeli regional objectives, who are willing to commit espionage and do end run around institutional barriers and open up informal channels in order to formalize or in order to achieve policy objectives of the group. So there is a case to be made that this is a network. This is a network that has violated many U.S. laws, that its contempt for international law and embracement of the noble lie has now come home to roost if we look at all of the activities that have run in contrary to U.S. statutes.
And mentioning Iran-Contra brings up, of course, Elliot Abrams, the son-in-law of the father of the neocons, Norman Panaritz, mm-hmm. who is the Washington's main man in dealing with Israel.
Yes, it's solid Republicans and Democrats who are concerned about the foreign policy establishment simply shake their heads when people like that re-enter government. And it also, I think, reveals a new weakness in our system that Americans can vote for a platform of a candidate. And if the foreign policy platform, such as George Bush, was a hands-off approach and letting other countries deal with problems and not interfering so much, and then the government comes in and you've got people like Elliot Abrams on the team, it really reveals the lack of voter influence in terms of political appointees who are going to have major impacts on what actually happens in the subsequent years.
One other thing that is that you get into the book as well, and is the prevalence of neocons and representatives of the think tanks who are constantly appearing as the talking heads on all the major TV programs. When they're asking for an opinion, they are brought in as so-called independent commentators. And you have actually Miroslav Wormser, who was one of the people who co-authored The Clean Break. She's, the head of the Hudson Institute.
Right. She made an interesting comment earlier this year that if things continued to go wrong in terms of Israel and the occupied territories, the Jordan option would have to be considered again. And for those who don't know, the Jordan option is the final expulsion of all Palestinians into Jordan. So she's certainly a luminary in this circuit. But the problem is twofold. Number one, who's appearing on the media to explain and frame the debate? And number two, how are they financed? I have looked at channels that you've mentioned, the Jerusalem Post and everything, of course, in the constellation of Conrad Black and Hollinger International. And what you find is not only an implicit but an explicit commitment to their sort of lacunic views of Israel and statements that outlets such as the Chicago Sun-Times will always be standing tall with the state of Israel. This is something David Radler, the publisher, has said, adding that he's responsible for meeting payroll and he'll determine what his papers say and how they're going to be run. So number one is channel. That channel is clearly going to only give you one type of spin on policy in the region. The other problem is the most ubiquitous people, such as David Brooks, even people such as George Will, have taken in enormous amounts of money from people like Conrad Black and Rupert Murdoch, who are neoconservative enablers, who not only facilitate their appearing endlessly on Fox News, but also provide the resources and motivation so that they can break into programs such as the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and become fixtures in terms of the neoconservative analyst who's omnipresent and always able to frame the debate. There's no other movement that's pulling in, for example, from Hollinger, $250,000 over the years as some of these news pundits have in order to provide this vital service to the neoconservative network.
There also, I listen to National Public Radio. We carry it on our station here, and at critical times for U.S. policy, they will go to some pundit at a university who will be treated as if this person is an independent source, and of course you'll recognize the name as being part of the neocon stable, but the listeners don't know it, and NPR does not identify them as what they are.
Right. Everyone's got a biography, and thankfully for websites such as SourceWatch and others, you can punch in the name, but it takes independent effort because the network is not always going to introduce someone. I've heard Dory Gold, for example, alternatively introduced as the advisor of Sharon, of Ariel Sharon, or the UN advisor, or a consultant. It's never the same. It's always sort of tailored to whatever he's going to expound upon. But you'll notice that in the run-up to the Iraq War, one of the foremost experts on Iraq, Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, was never on mainstream or network news. He finally broke in only after, when he was giving very accurate predictions and analysis of what was happening. But in the key moment, you're going to get Richard Pearl.
And actually, yeah, Juan Cole might come on at a low crisis moment where there's not anything happening in which listeners might actually be thinking of taking some kind of an action.
Right. So I think it's, you know, in terms of the mainstream news media, we've written a lot about how it's financed, how neoconservatives essentially plundered one company, which was Hollinger International, and are now involved in various shareholder suits, but questioning how financing is enabling a continuous and essentially ungraded. If you look at some of the predictions many of these luminaries have made, they've turned out to be completely wrong, and yet we're treated to their analysis and ongoing presence regardless of what they said in the past. And I think that has backlash after a while.
Before we're coming down toward the end of the hour, one person you write about is somebody who's very important player in Washington, and I've never seen anyone write in detail about him before, and that's Frank Gaffney in the
yes.
Center for Security Policy.
Right.
Perhaps you could tell a little bit about him and the role he plays.
Well, Frank Gaffney is a cheerleader for unlimited military spending, and unlimited military spending is something that in general feeds the neoconservative network in terms of consulting fees, etc. For example, in the most recent Boeing tanker deal with the U.S. government, many neoconservatives were promoting leasing, including Frank Gaffney. Behind the scenes, however, Boeing was doling out $20 million gifts, for example, to Richard Pearl's investment fund in exchange, we believe, for promoting what was a fatally flawed package, which would have cost U.S. taxpayers much more than simply buying appropriate tankers outright. Frank Gaffney plays a key role in promoting the dogma of unlimited military spending, missile defense, and more than simply a dedication to unlimited spending, building the power of the network by playing an intermediary role in brokering major contracts. For example, if we were to assume that the commission that Boeing gave to Richard Pearl for pushing the tanker deal is a standard sort of fee for promoting this type of deal, that's about 0.0741% of the total package. That would represent, if that's going on with other major defense contractors in this world of unlimited spending, to about $380 million to key conservative, neoconservative players for their advice, policy papers, think tank media appearances, investment funds, speaking fees, research grants, etc. So it creates, by people like Frank Gaffney, essentially are rainmakers for this entire network and creating the funds they need to dominate our policy.
Grant, we're coming down now to end the program. I want people to be able to know how to get your book.
Sure.
And also your website. This is really very important. We're going to have you back here again. But
excellent. I appreciate that. IRMEP.org. People can buy the book directly, the cover on the webpage. It's also available through Amazon, Powell's, and other online bookstores.
Can independent bookstores get it if they order it?
Absolutely.
Very good.
All of these are available.
As we push our independent bookstores here in Mendocino.
Yes, sir.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being our guest, Grant Smith, author of Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America. I'm going to have you back again because we just began to cover what's in this book. I recommend to all of you go out and get it. It'll get your blood boiling, get you moving, taking action. Grant, thanks very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.